You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Carmen, aren't you going to rinse it first?
Rinse it?
You gotta rinse it for salmonella.
No, you rinse it. The sink, you're gonna get fucking salmonella all over the place.
Oh.
Ron, do you wash your chickens before cooking them?
No, I buy my chickens pre-washed. I actually buy my chickens pre-cooked. I actually try not to eat chicken that often. I try to reduce the amount of meat, non-seafood meat that I eat. So
gotcha.
When I am eating chicken, it's usually like in a chicken sandwich or a chicken salad. Right. So
I've been trying to get some more protein in my diet. So I've been doing this thing where I get a bunch of chicken breasts and bake them and then freeze them or keep them in the refrigerator. And I had this whole methodology of washing and drying them and oil and salt and pepper, all this stuff. And then I watched this episode and I was like, Yeah, I'm putting a lot of work into salmonella protection. And then when Carmi says you're just getting salmonella everywhere, I was like, oh, maybe I should just stop it because it's going to bake off anyway. Everything's going to bake off anyway, so it doesn't matter.
So yeah, so is that the solution that it just bakes off?
I think that's what I'm taking away from
that's
it.
That's my takeaway. Should we be getting our health tips from...
from the bear?
From a television show.
Well... Maybe it's not a bad source given who else is in charge of health related decisions in this country at the moment. But anyway, we're not here for that.
Right.
Have you another question for you? Have you ever eaten tonnato? The white sauce that.
Uh-oh, what is that?
It's the sauce that Donna says to him when she's relating that conversation about her trip to Italy. Right. And it's a white sauce that looks disgusting or whatever. And I had never heard of it either. And apparently it's anchovies and tuna and something else. And I Googled it real quick. And it looks just kind of like this white dog's vomit sauce.
Yeah, it sounds gross.
Yeah.
Sounds absolutely gross. No, thank you.
But delicious. My other question for you is, have you ever eaten at a Michelin star restaurant or a Michelin star styled restaurant?
Well, I came close to almost, but not really. So one of the more infamous stories a long time ago, this woman I was dating was a foodie and we lived in the Bay Area and I was going to surprise her and take her to the French Laundry. Where Karm worked, right?
Yeah.
This, the world famous French Laundry.
Yeah.
So we were driving back from a wedding. And I said, I have a surprise for you. And she couldn't wait to do it. So we drive up to the French Laundry. I had no idea you were supposed to book a year in advance. So I'm rolling up to the French Laundry like it's McDonald's. I'm like, you know, a table for two, please.
And they're like, Ron, you were laughing so hard you hit your desk and it interrupted the, the microphone and it broke the recording connection. So
right. So I'll wash my hands. So we roll up. So I walk into French Laundry and like, table for two, please. And the maitre d' is like, and what's your name? Do you have a reservation? No. But I saw open tables. I'm like, can we just sit over there? And so my girlfriend, obviously, who she understand the French Laundry, and she was like, you brought me to the French Laundry and you didn't make a reservation. And the maitre d', to her credit, she was very nice about it. She was like, well, most people book a year in advance. I'm like, a year? A year in
and your girlfriend's just embarrassed as hell, right?
She's totally embarrassed. I'm like, who the fuck books a restaurant a year in advance?
Yeah.
All right.
You know, all these Applebee's people sitting nearby? Over here, that's who did it.
Like, is there an Applebee's nearby? Anyway, that's the closest I've ever gotten to eating at a Michelin star.
Did that cause the breakup?
No.
Okay, good.
Many other
good.
Things caused breakup.
Right. Fair enough.
But yeah, so no, how about you?
We ate at a restaurant in Seattle. Not long ago, actually last year, it was our 10th wedding anniversary, and we went to a restaurant near to where we got married, and then a place that we had dinner with friends like a night or two after our wedding, who couldn't come to the wedding, but they came in and took us out to dinner. And it has since changed hands, so the place wasn't what we remembered, and then it was part of this restaurant group. They have a named chef in Seattle, and the group has like three or four restaurants around town and stuff. And yeah, we ate food that I never thought was possible that you could eat. There was some stuff. It was just like, wow, this is incredible. And there was that inherent tension of this is elevated food. Mm-hmm. I wasn't prepared for elevated food because we thought we were going to a homey comfort place that we had been to before that was elevated, but still kind of pub like food, but still very simple and familiar. And so there was that challenge. And then the other challenge of just like, what do I do with this? I'm not in this world, so I'm not prepared for processing this. And we came for comfort and we didn't, you know, not for food exploration. Like, we're going to go to the Met and see this new artist and their new installation or something like that. Like, I think there's some preparation involved if you're not of that world and in constantly eating in that way. So,
yeah. And, you know, there's a famous restaurant in Berkeley called Chez Panisse.
Yeah. Right.
I think I've eaten there. Isn't that a Michelin star restaurant?
I'm sure it is. It's up there. It's in that world. Yeah.
Right. I ate there a long time ago, back when I was in college. So
okay.
I don't know if it was a Michelin star back then. So if that counts, then that probably counts.
So Ron, we're actually here to talk about season four of The Bear. Oh yes,
we're talking about The Bear.
And I was trying to do prep for this season for us so we could go in and talk cogently about the episode or the season and the episode, the acting and all this stuff. And man, this season has such a level of depth and episode to episode and season to season construction and interstitial stuff that I can't, without having done a full episode to episode, scene to scene breakdown, I'm having trouble getting my hands around it and getting my head around it. And before we recorded this last week, I went back and watched season one, episode one, and then season four, episodes one and two, and then 9 and 10, just to kind of back in the world. Because my wife and I were watching it on and off when we were on vacation earlier this summer.
And
all that kind of stuff. I don't know how you're relating to this season, but I thought, well, maybe what'll work is we have a hot pot of ideas and thoughts and concepts. And rather than being a definitive season four recap, and this is the Lorehounds, you know, official blah, 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 let's just talk.
Yeah.
And just like talk about the season and talk about our feelings and our thoughts. Because I don't know about you, man, but this show was on another level for me this year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it works for the watch. If it works for the watch podcast, it can work for us. We can just talk about the season at a high level.
Exactly. Hey everyone, David here. Wanted to tell you about a company that makes some really beautiful Middle Earth inspired products. Actually, I wish I had discovered OSHA slings when my daughter was little and I was using a lot of different baby slings and carriers. They sent me one of their Ancients of Gondor Ithildan baby carriers. Honestly, the design of this carrier is cool as hell. The quality is impeccable. It's a really smart design and super easy to use. I wish I had this when I needed it. I would have loved to show off my dad nerd cred at the time. But they also sent me a really nice blanket, the Misty Mountains Throw. And now that same daughter, she monopolizes it whenever she's on the couch. It's beautiful, just the right weight. It's brushed cotton, so it's breathable and keeps us really cozy. We've been having a lot of cold weather lately, so we're always fighting over who gets to use it. A little about OSHA. They're a family-owned Scottish company. They've been handcrafting products since about 2010. Everything's ethically sourced and made in their solar-powered workshop. Check out their website. They've got a bunch of information about their sustainability practices. That's something that's really important to me. And they have this huge line of official Lord of the Rings products. They're making baby carriers, throws, scarves, mugs, tea towels, and the designs are stunning. Like, go check out the website right now. There's a link in the show notes. New customers get 10% off with the code LOREHOUNDS. Go to oshaslings.com.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
So where would you put this season? Like, if you were ranking the seasons, where would you put this season for you?
I think this is my favorite season.
Really? You think this is better than season one?
Yeah.
Why?
Because...
That's a bold statement, David.
I think there's a lot of reasons, and obviously I'm not prepared for your question as much, so right. I'm kind of thinking off the top of my head here, and so sure, some things
those are the best kind of questions.
Yeah, exactly. The actors are very finely tuned to their characters, and so their portrayals, mm-hmm. and knowing who the character is, and I think this is really important in this season, is that all of these characters have been on a tremendous arc.
Mm-hmm.
And we're getting resolution to stuff that happened in 1, 2, and 3. And to be able to pull off the subtlety and the sense of process that the person, the technical skill of the portrayal of showing this person who has been going through all of this trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And re-aggravating that trauma on a daily basis. To starting to find resolution and to mm-hmm. starting to find the grace to be able to allow to hear other people
mm-hmm.
who are as hurting as badly as they are, and to be able to start to come to some accords and some healing, that is a next level skill on this acting, in television acting for me.
Right,
then we've
right.
got things like. We've got this great pantheon of characters and they're all clicking seamlessly. And then this show, the way that it uses music and the way that the music is integrated for me this season is otherworldly.
Mm.
Like, I'm really transported. I hear an old familiar song, with Led Zeppelin, episode 1 of season 4. That's the way. That's the way it ought to be.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm instantly in that scene, and I'm aware of the song, and I'm grooving with the song, but I'm also with Carmi and Mikey, and I can smell the tomato sauce and I can hear it sticking and all of that. And so for me, on all these different levels, and then the editing, and right, we can talk about all of this stuff, but all to me, the show is really coming together in a way that I don't think I could have predicted or.
Mm-hmm.
And it's breaking all these rules of standard television. This is not The Pit. This is not Slow Horses. This is not Andor, which is also breaking ground this year.
Right.
But it's the arc of the characters and the arc of the story. The episode lengths were all over the place because they were doing what they needed to do to tell the story that they wanted to tell for that episode.
Mm-hmm.
So like all of these factors combined to me, it's like Tenado. Like it kind of looks like a mess on paper, but then when you eat it, you're just like, oh my God, I've never eaten Tenado. So I wouldn't know that, but I'm going off of Didi's description of it.
Yeah.
I don't know. Does that answer your question? I feel like I'm rambling a little bit.
No. I think it's good. And obviously, I think it's interesting you mentioned the music. I mean, for me, I'll just say, I think for me, seasons 1 and 2 are kind of hard to beat.
Sure.
This would fall into like third place for me.
Okay.
And it's interesting you mentioned music because I, you know, my current girlfriend and I, we rewatched seasons 1 and then we were like halfway through season 2. And it was just, I remember.
Just recently you were rewatching them.
Yeah. Like just this week and last week.
Okay.
We had like our 5-year anniversary a couple of weeks ago. We went to Disneyland for a couple of days.
Oh, fun. And congratulations.
Back at our motel/hotel. Mm-hmm. It was advertised as a hotel, but it was pretty much a motel.
Nice.
We still have a sore spot about that. Anyway,
you didn't book a year in advance, my friend.
Exactly right. Anyway, we started watching it. And, but this week, I remember watching, it was the episode, I think it was episode 202, so season 2, episode 2 or 3. Right. It's the one where Sid is going around Chicago and she's experimenting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and that's then, a great episode. And then the needle drop, I think the song is called Future Perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the first time hearing it, it was just such an evocative song. I never heard it before. And the way the editing had gone with the music, they had all these vista shots of Chicago, they had these quick edits of the food that she was tasting, and it was sort of like this really beautiful montage of her journey. We couldn't tell, was this all happening on the same day, because her outfit wasn't changing. If it is, she's eating a lot of food on this day.
I remember having that same thought. Like, damn. Like,
is this the same? And then she's going and she's visiting these restaurants and she's talking to people. And it's like, there's a lot happening on this day. If this is all happening on the same day. All that to say is, I kind of felt like in the first 2 seasons, the use of music, because so much of the music, at least for me, was music I hadn't heard, it really gave it that sort of indie film feel that I really enjoyed about the first 2 seasons. And I agree with you. I think the use of music in this season is equally strong, but they were more recognizable songs, and there's nothing necessarily wrong with that. But
if you use them in the right way though, right? You can.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I think back to the Dune for Dune. I guess it was the first Dune movie. Oh God! What was it? It was the first one of the trailers.
Villeneuve and, Dune movie.
Yeah, Villeneuve. And for
sure, we're talking about first Dune movies.
Yeah, absolutely. Because God bless David Lynch and Gotham, but
that was a freaky movie.
I love it so. It's a hot mess, but God, I love it. Anyway, the first Dune Villeneuve Dune movie. I think they used a Pink Floyd song in the trailer, and it was like, oh yeah, that's a great hook. And there's nowhere in the movie.
And when
I heard popular music in this season, every single time they used a known song, it worked.
Yes.
Like they actually thought about why this song is here and I have a suspicion that if you go through season 4 and every single song that's at the end of the episode,
mm-hmm.
that bridges us out from whatever is going on screen into our credits or, you know, cut to dark and then go credits. that that song has a specific point of it being there.
Right.
So that makes me think, because there's a couple of songs I'm like, oh, wait, yeah, they're saying something here, and I haven't done an actual analysis of it yet. But that makes me think that every song in this season, the care and the craft that they're building this, that they built this season for, I think there's nothing is misplaced in this.
Sure. Yeah. No, I agree with that. In fact, I just rewatched the finale last night, and I specifically wanted to sit through and hear. I was really digging on the song. I mean, that was a song I don't remember ever hearing. I wasn't familiar with that song. And so, yeah, I think the use of song this year.
Fast Slow Disco by St. Vincent. Yeah, I've added that to my favorites list now.
Yeah, it's good. So
it's really good.
Yeah. I think, you know, if I can use this analogy, I think it's apropos analogy. The show creators really know how to cook. They know how to use the ingredients of music and editing and cinematography and acting to put together meals. And I kind of feel like this season is one of those, at least for me, one of those seasons where, like, depending on when the food critic comes, you're going to get like an amazing review and maybe even that Michelin star, or like maybe just an okay review. Cause like, I feel like there were a couple episodes. I don't feel like there was a bad episode, at least for me, necessarily in the bunch.
Yeah.
I feel like there was just some that just really stood out more than others. And we could probably get to a couple of them. And without, we don't need to go into detail with each one, but in terms of like why they really like stood out. And so like, you know, one that comes to mind for me is the Worms episode, which I think is episode 4. That was the one where Sid goes
Worms,
get her hair done and she hangs out with TJ. It was written by the actor who plays Sid.
Ayo Edebiri.
Ayo Edebiri. And the dude who plays Marcus, is it something Boyce?
Lionel Boyce.
Lionel Boyce, yeah.
We so just I have like 5 screens up with all these like breakdowns of songs and episodes.
I love your preparation.
Well, you know, thanks to the great AI in the sky for helping me speed my work on that. So anyway,
but I think that's a good example of like where they were really cooking, because you know it was kind of, I wouldn't call it necessarily, it wasn't a bottle episode, but it was episode where she was detached from the normal. I wouldn't say normal, the regular storylines, you know, even in so much that the other characters were involved. And the, you know, that's when they had Danielle Detweiler as her cousin. Mm-hmm. Like even in the scene where it's like these little subtle things. So she's talking to Sydney, and see, one thing I picked up on when she's talking to Sydney, she's talking how she would normally talk. And then when she picks up the phone, she totally like instantly code switches.
Yeah.
And it was like the subtle thing where you get a really feel for the taste of who this character is, how she operates in the world, how she operates with, you know, her cousin Sydney. And then when Sydney was telling the story of, I love the fact when she's telling the story to little TJ about the two houses she might want to spend the night at. And it's obviously supposed to be a metaphor. It is a metaphor for the two jobs she's trying to decide.
Right.
And then at the end of the episode, TJ's like, I think you should work wherever you want to work. You're a really good cook. Like she knew all along what she was talking about. She thought she was being sly.
Right.
And so it's these little things that really stand out. So that was like a standout episode, you know, for me. Aside from the big one, you know, the wedding episode and the finale. Is there an episode for you that particularly stood out?
Yeah, I think before I do that, I think my episode is going to be episode 9 for a couple of reasons. But I wanted
is that the one with Donna?
Yeah, with Donna. But it's also there's a couple of key conversations because there's that one, but. Sydney and Cicero have a conversation as well that I found particularly moving And so anyway, but before we get into that really quick, this topic of bottle episodes really quick, there's like a way sideways. I want to bottle this.
I love it.
I think we should start to shift the definition of knowing, you know, not just as a let it culturally drift, but I think we should just intentionally drift it. A bottle episode is a standalone episode that breaks out a character or a plot line separate from the rest of the episodes. I think that in a season, I think that's how we're using it now. A lot of times we want to call it that.
Right.
And what do they call that when the path, you know, when architects, you know, through a park, they make these like winding paths and then you see the brown grass where everybody is just walking.
Right.
It's called, so that has a name where people are like, there's a whole psychology behind it. And it's like I forget what it's called. Anyway, people just are going that way and we just keep going that way with bottle episodes. So I think we should just intentionally say that bottle episodes are now these breakout little sub stories or character moments. Because bottle episode in the old sense of serial, you know, in previous TV, 26 seasons, live audiences, bottle episodes were, you know, you were reusing cast and story and sets in a particular way. So that's my opinion about that.
Yeah, no, I like it.
Yeah. Anyway, I think, and we have to talk about Shapiro too in a little bit relative to Sydney, but Tonado. So
I have some thoughts on Shapiro.
On Shapiro.
Yeah.
Well, do you think he's faking it? Do you think he really has the money?
I think he has the money. I found it interesting because the way he's trying, so the episode where she comes over, I think this was the hair episode too, or the episode before or after, where he invites her over to the restaurant. And he's like playing like this hip hop music.
Yeah.
And it's like, is this what he's normally playing? He's just assuming. And then he gives her like the remote and she can pick whatever she wants. And then she picks Fleur-de-Lis, I think, by Beethoven.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And he's like, oh man, Mozart. And she's like, Beethoven. And so like one, I just think it was so funny that, like, here's this dude. He's trying to be cool. He's kind of be hip. He's inviting this black woman over.
Fronting in a big way.
Assuming that she's going to like hip hop and she prefers Beethoven. He doesn't even know it's Beethoven. He thinks it's Mozart, which could mean like maybe he really is into hip hop and he doesn't know classical. I don't know.
Right.
But then even later in the episode, he says something about, we can have like Afrofuturistic. He talks about some type of Afrofuturistic type of food or something. And I just felt like, what is this? It felt very microaggression-y in a sense, in terms of what he was trying to do and how he was trying to like win her over. I think it's interesting. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I was just saying, I think it's interesting that he uses his real name in the show because I was looking him up. I was like, Adam, that's his, like,
that's his real name. He's a real chef.
That's his real name, Adam Shapiro. So like, is he real? But back to your question, I do think he has the money because,
okay,
was he the top chef at ever?
He was with at Olivia Colman's restaurant, whatever that
was. Right. So he was probably like the sous chef or something. So
he was a
big name chef.
Yeah.
I didn't see anything, maybe there's something you missed, but I didn't see anything that suggests to me like he didn't have the ability to actually do it.
He didn't have
the money to open it.
Right. Yeah. I have this, I just have this like sinking feeling that like his restaurant is going to fall through and, you know, but maybe that's just, I'm interpreting the show or I'm predicting the show on, this is what we do with television, right? We're like, what's the pattern? And we've seen this before. And so maybe I'm just trying to over predict the show, but I'm like suspicious of him for that. But that said, I think he's totally fetishizing her and sort of kind of tokenizing her and trying to use her. I don't think he ever really would have ever given her the full creativity, the freedom, the creative freedom that he was selling her on. I think he would have boxed her in and then he would have hitched her as some of his fuel to fuel his thing, not a true collaboration. So I don't think it would have worked out for her in the long run. I think she would have been less satisfied.
I think she would have been less satisfied as well. I don't know if I'm ready to, or if I would say that he is
fetishizing her or.
Yeah, fetishizing her or using her. I mean, I think to some extent he knows that she's a talented chef. I think maybe he knows because we learn in the last episode that he's been talking to Carm that.
Yeah. Right.
He's been. So I think that actually kind of reveals a positive aspect of his character. Like he wasn't trying to do this behind Carm's back. He's like, hey, Carm, just letting you know, I've been talking to Sid. And
that's a good point. I like that.
I think so. There's that aspect of it. And I think if he's talking to Carm, he knows from Carm how good Sidney is, either directly or indirectly, either, you know, because of maybe how Carm has talked about Sidney and he knows the quality that Carmen requires. And then based on, I'm sure, conversations they've had in the past about how good Sidney is. And so I think, you know, Adam wants his restaurant to pop and having a chef who's not just a talented chef, but we know from season one, she's smart about business and kitchen maintenance and management. And so she has a good head on her shoulders with regards to how to run a kitchen. And so, you know, I think, when you have a talent like that, you really want them because you want your restaurant to be the best. And I think the show has established that she's one of the best chefs in Chicago. And so wouldn't he want her?
Did you like the little fake out of the best new chef for Food and Wine with Marcus instead of Sid?
Yeah, yeah. Because they really set you up to think it's going to be.
Totally.
Yeah.
And even Carmi looks at her like, hey, you know, you got this girl. And then boom, the reveal.
But I think it was interesting in rewatching season one.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love these little callback.
Yeah. Yeah.
Carm is
yeah.
having a conversation with Marcus and he's talking about when Food and Wine named him best chef. And so having just recently seen this episode, obviously I didn't remember it from the first time, but now when I rewatch season one, and I see this conversation between Carm and Marcus, Carm is telling Marcus about when Food and Wine had named Carm best new chef. The way it came full circle, I thought was pretty cool.
I think I was saying this too at the top of the episode, that this is the difficulty that I have in normally for a season wrap. We've usually, or a one shot, we break it down and we have a skeleton and sort of an organized structure to attach to things. And to me, this season is so filled with these interstitial moments that jump from episode to season,
right?
That it's like so hard to understand where all these things come from. And when I think about the dream sequence that Carmi has in season one, episode one, which I did rewatch just this week.
Right.
And then we have a dream sequence this episode, and they're both related to the formulation of the bear and its sort of emotional origin points and, you know, the clock and there's all these things that you can't.
Real quick.
Yeah.
What dream episode are you talking? Because there's like two dreams Carmi's having. There's a dream of the bear, and there's that dream sequence where he's like in a television cooking show, and it's a nightmare. Which one of the dream sequences?
I was thinking of more specifically of the bear. It's like the bear. Uncaging the bear on the bridge. Yes. Yeah, at the very beginning. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's just so hard to follow all these little rhizomatic connections across all the different episodes. They're just so connected and bounce off each other and fold and wrap. It just creates this incredible richness. And so when you do strike on those moments, they're really special and add a level of vibe, emotional vibe, as well as sort of intellectual, like, oh, wow, yeah, I remember that. Or that makes me, you know, oh, yeah, I've just drawn the parallels between this, that, and the other thing. And it makes you feel good as a viewer. You're right. Like, hey, look at me, like I'm smart.
Well, it's interesting you bring up the dream, because when Carm says to Sydney at in the finale, you are the bear. Mm-hmm. I think he's talking about the dream.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, the, see, you know, like, this saying? Is, we're doing it right now. This is very meta, because exactly. This is exactly the thing.
Because, you know, when you first see the dream, you think the bear is him. And maybe at that point it really was. Like, maybe it's evolved. But if you were to assume that, you know, Christopher Storr had, you know, the creator of the show, he always had a mind to come to this point. And he always had a mind that the bear was Sydney, or that was, because I think the first time we see him have the dream, he hasn't even met Sydney yet. So at the time, but it could represent somebody outside of him who's either better or who's going to take his spot, whatever that means, right? Or some challenge he has to face. And so, and he doesn't know exactly yet what that challenge is. And I think the challenge is giving up restaurant, giving up cooking, and giving up to Sid. So Sid represents the bear.
You just said, like, in that last two, three sentences, you said about five different things that I'm like trying to keep track of. But I want to go back to the bear thing first. Yeah. And one of these days we're going to get to my favorite episode, but yeah, I think my favorite episode can actually, my favorite episode actually contains a lot of this stuff. Mm-hmm. There's an element of magical realism. There's, there's this underlying, all along, it's the sandwich guys. And finally, the computer and Rob Reiner's character get together.
Right.
And there's all this stuff about recovery and trauma. Editing is a big part of. So for me, episode 9 has almost everything from this season in this perfect sort of episode. Yeah. But I want to go back really quickly to this idea of the dream, and sometimes how our dreams seem prescient, but like, how do we know that, or why, like, what vibrations are going on in the universe that might, you know, allow me to pick up on something or whatnot. And to me, in this show, there is a definite element of magical realism that exists in this really weird way. I hate using the food metaphors all the time, but there's just a hint of it. That if it was too much, it would change the show radically. And if it's not there, then it doesn't actually give the show that extra special thing. And I'm thinking of the at the wedding when they all get underneath the table. Mm-hmm. Like, that's just physiologically and physically impossible.
I was trying to figure out, where are they exactly? Is that a table? I mean, and it seemed like it was getting bigger. It was kind of like.
It was. Yes. And that's what I mean.
Felix the cat's hat.
Oh yeah.
It kind of like Felix,
or you mean
Tesseract from?
Yeah. So that's one of these elements that I'm thinking of with the magical realism. Another one is Carmi finding the green sweater, finding Claire Bear's green sweater in his closet when he's over visiting his mom.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a couple more, and I wish I might. It's buried in my notes somewhere else, but there's this definite use of real adjunct parallel magical realism things that I think just makes the show that much more special, but never than actually crossing the line over too far. And then we all just go, oh, okay, well, this is magical realism done, right? And now it's completely different. Because for me, this show is very, very real, and it's very grounded and very real human.
Mm-hmm.
The human condition and things. So
what about the sweater made you feel like it was magical realism, finding the sweater?
How she left that, you know, because they have the conversation at the wedding and she says, oh, you know, if you go over to your mom's, I left this green sweater over there one time.
Right.
And, you know, bring it back to me. She's like, and as this kind of like hero's quest thing, like, if you really love me, you'll come up with the sweater. Not that she would really do that, but it was kind of one of those playful things that couples might do, right? Like, show me you love me, right? Like, I want to see, I want to see you experiencing the love that we're feeling here by doing this right. thing or retrieving this thing for me. And so he finds the sweater, and that is so unlikely that the sweater from 20 plus years ago that he would just mm-hmm. walk into a closet, just see it and take it down off the shelf.
Right.
It's super highly improbable, but it is one of those beautiful little moments that do happen in life where there's just some weird coincidence. There's no way to explain it. And yet it connects to something that makes you feel both small and big at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I can't understand that.
Yeah. And so for him to find that sweater, just that, and knowing that they've already sort of reestablished their connection in the, during the wedding episode, but now, like, you know, it, when life, I don't know if you've experienced this, like sometimes when you're on the quote unquote right path for yourself and in that moment of, in that stage of your life, things just seem to be clicking and stuff mm-hmm. just seems to be coming to you in unexpected, but positive in ways that take you forward positively. And to me, it's that's, again, one of those elements of Carmi's on the right path, removing himself from the restaurant and starting to heal from the trauma of the loss of his father, the alcoholism of his mother, and the suicide of his brother. And then the traumatization of being, you know, of what that other chef did to him at that other restaurant.
Oh, right. Yeah.
That he's... And which is what we get into the final episode, right? Where he's saying, look, I'm trying to, you know, oh, can I play a clip? I have a clip.
Yes, please.
I have a clip. Okay. This is a little bit long, but I think it goes to the point of this thing of breaking patterns. So we're going to segue, and I want to talk about this whole thing of recovery and breaking patterns mm-hmm. and stuff.
You know, I'm learning that too. Okay. I've been going to meetings like 3 times a week, I'm talking about mistakes and God and shit. Then the more you do that, the more you realize that people are not so different.
Like who?
Like you. You and her. Yeah, you're both real sensitive. You're both real intense.
I'm not sure you know me well enough to say that.
Okay. But I think you leaving was a smart thing to do. And I don't think you should bust your own balls over it.
How come?
Because sometimes to break patterns, you got to break patterns, man. And I'm sure it's not easy.
So that was Bob Odenkirk as Uncle Lee and talking with Carmi at the wedding where they share, instead of going mm-hmm. out having a cigarette, they're sharing right, some nicotine gum. So what did you hear in that? Because there's so much to me in there that's packed with that.
Well, I think there is, like you hear in Carmi's voice, almost... a sense of, I don't know if annoyance is the right word, but a little put off of the fact that he feels like Bob's character is being presumptuous. When he mm-hmm. says, yeah, yeah. I don't think you know me well enough.
Yep.
But I kind of feel like he knows, like, what's Bob's character's name again?
Lee, Uncle Lee. It was Absolutely. His dad's yeah. brother. Yeah.
Yeah. He knows Lee is actually correct, I think, in his assessment of Carm. And he doesn't like the fact that he's correct.
Yeah.
And he's saying, well, you don't know me well enough to make that judgment. Mm-hmm. But he kind of does. Or he does, obviously. Whether or not he does or not, you know, he kind of pegged him. And I think Carm knows that.
Yeah.
So I think that bothers Carm
yeah.
to some extent.
And I think what's interesting too that I took out of it, and at some point we're going to talk about episode 10 and that final conversation, that what Carmi is trying to do in that moment of episode 10 that nobody else is really understanding is that he's trying to break a pattern to break a pattern. Mm-hmm. They're saying your pattern is always to run away from the challenging, difficult, painful things. And by leaving the restaurant, you're doing that pattern. And he's saying, yeah, I get that, but I'm trying to break that pattern by breaking the pattern of me running away. And the only way for me to break that pattern is to actually sort of run away. And he gets that advice from Uncle Lee, there is a lot of resentment and upset in there because of the family dynamic of him stepping in as a quasi father figure and getting close to their mother and everybody being a little bit uncomfortable about that. But then I love the way that they don't ever say, oh, I'm in a 12-step program or I'm attending Alcoholics Anonymous or whatever. They never call it out, but both Uncle Lee and Donna are clearly active in recovery groups.
Yes.
And are being supported by the frameworks and structures that are within those groups to be able to start to deal with their trauma and then start to deal with repairing the relationships in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so I find it really interesting that in this conversation, Uncle Lee, who clearly Carmi has some antagonism towards, he actually takes that piece of truth that he says about breaking patterns, and then he actually uses that in trying to get himself out of getting out of the dominant position at being at the restaurant.
So do you think that? Do you think he hadn't made the decision yet by that point?
I think he had made the decision. I think when he made the decision when he left Claire's, wasn't it? And he calls up Petey and says, hey, I forget what happened. That was somewhere in the middle of the season.
Okay.
So I think he had made the decision, but in the conversation with Sid and Richie, I think he had new ways to explain. He had new ways to attempt to explain why running away is actually breaking the pattern. Not running away, but leaving the restaurant is the way for him to break the pattern of, I'm going to put myself into my cooking to the degree that my sense of self, I'm channeling my trauma all. I'm reflecting my trauma. I'm spewing it all back at you guys by dumping myself into and not dealing with it. Now I'm affecting you all by it. I need to stop doing that. And to stop doing that, I need to step away from being the center of the restaurant.
Right. Yeah.
I can see that. And I think that conversation allowed him to perceive it in a different way and have some different words to explain it to Sid and Richie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. What do you make of the whole way that they're using recovery support groups in the show? Like I said, they never call it out. Like I never heard them say, here's my coin or my sponsor said I should talk to you. And here's my checklist of this is how I'm supposed to apologize, take accountability.
I like how they're using it. I forget which episode it was this season, but I feel like this season and previous seasons have had a really strong monologue from someone in the AA meeting.
Yeah.
In one of the earlier seasons, it was Carm. Another season was Molly Ringwald's character.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot about that.
I think from season one, yeah. And then this season, I don't remember the actor's name, but I remember after hearing, it was like one of these, I think it was a one-shot monologue, like a slow pushing, you know, unbroken. And I remember after watching it, thinking to myself, like, that's the kind of role you get where you, like, you scream to all your friends, I got this amazing role on this amazing show, The Bear. And it's like, one of the, like, that's the one time we see her.
Yeah.
But it's totally going to stand out.
Meteoric.
It's going to put her on the radar of a bunch of casting directors. And so I like how they've used, you know, the scenes in the AA meetings. And in a lot of ways, the whole show is about recovery. I mean, the show is about, you know, there's so much dysfunction in this family. I think is, you know, one of the, is it John Mulaney's character who specifically says like he likes
he's at the wedding.
It.
Yeah.
And he's like, he feeds on it. Right. So you have all of this dysfunction. You have substance abuse, emotional abuse.
Yeah.
And, I think it's a common theme that runs throughout the entire show, recovery. And what are the choices we have to make in order to overcome and recover from our past trauma?
And I think this is something that's really unique about this show, is that they could have kept going with the intensity from season one and two of people shouting at each other and having all this high drama. But instead, they really worked hard in season three and season four at bending now the arc of the characters, instead of just continuing off in one direction, which is, okay, we just keep remaking the show and giving everybody that visceral high of the argument and the back and forth, to actually moving us into this more subtle and nuanced space of what does it mean to take accountability for your actions in the past.
And I think, you know, when you come to, you know, episode 10 and Carmen's decision, I think that's one of the controversies surrounding the show now, is the decision for him to, you know, to leave.
Right.
Like, where does this go? When is it realistic? Where does the show go from there?
Yeah.
What does that mean? What is that going to look like?
Where are you? What are your opinions about episode 10?
It's clearly designed like a play because it all takes place.
It was about halfway through and I'm like, oh my God, this is so theatrical. And I'm like, by the end of the episode, I was like, that was a one act play.
right. But I liked how they did it, because oftentimes when a television show does that, where it does something that is clearly designed to be like a play, it sometimes feels like a play. Mm-hmm. So one thing that comes to mind to me, I was recently watching Mountain Head.
What did you think of that?
I didn't finish it. I need to go back to it. But it was feeling too, like, I don't like it when a show feels like they're making it like a play, if that makes sense. It's hard to really put words into it, but it feels like, oh, they're acting this. Because when you act in a play, you have to act a certain way because you're acting to an audience, whatever. And I don't know. I don't know if I'm explaining myself very well. But sometimes when you have these episodes that are like little mini plays, they feel like you're doing a play versus, like, so for instance, when I think about Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah.
And like I think about the scene, the cutting ear scene, right? Technically, you could say that could be in a play, but it doesn't. You don't feel like you're watching a play when you see that scene. And there are lots of little scenes in that movie that could be like plays. There's two people in the room talking.
A lot of Tarantino stuff. Yeah, I get you.
Same thing about Pulp Fiction.
Sure.
But I never feel like the opening scene in Pulp Fiction in the cafeteria. I never feel like I'm watching a play.
Right.
So sometimes I feel like when I'm watching a show that is a regular TV show, a lot of different locations, and then they have this one bottom episode.
See what I mean? See, right. There. It was where right there
everyone's
too.
Just there. Sometimes it feels like sometimes it feels like a play.
Yeah.
And it kind of takes me out.
It's like an uncanny valley thing.
That's a great example. Yes.
Yeah.
An uncanny valley, like it feels like a play and it's taking me out.
Yeah.
All that to say, I feel like this one kind of like straddles it. Like I didn't have that uncanny valley feeling because one, it took a while before I realized, oh, we haven't moved location yet. And so like, we're still in the, like, we haven't gone to any other, we haven't seen any other.
Right. It's just them locations. In the back of the.
Yeah. And so.
And then we have one door where people enter in. Nobody actually exits, right? We just keep adding. Yeah.
People come in. So. I thought they put it off well.
I wonder how many cameras they filmed that with, because the way, like, and how many takes, and God, in the edit to try to match that tonally, because that the tonal, the emotional vibrations that were rolling off the screen were just exquisite. It felt real and it felt earned. And it felt like, and one of the things that I really appreciate about the show is that they're breaking rules of what an episode of television would normally be, like a little mini three-act play in each episode. This thing, they were just like, no, we're doing this. This is where they are. They walk out after work, and this is what happens. And this is a conversation that you could have with these people. And I thought it was brilliant top to bottom. I absolutely loved it.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because I read this article on Esquire,
yeah,
by Jonah Rosenberg, and he specifically described it as anti-TV. So it's funny that you
okay. So now I'm gonna have to go read this article, right?
Yeah. And one of the things he was talking about in this article was the controversy around the episode. Would Carm really do that? And he told the story of how. It's not uncommon for people to have a pivot shift in their career, in their life. And
it's
his own personal story. Like, he used to be an audio engineer and now he's a writer. He writes about TV, entertainment, and sports and stuff for Esquire. And so he was using his own personal story as an example of how he could relate to Carm making a decision as big as no longer being a chef. Like, maybe he'll go on and be a professor at the CAA or something like that, you know? And so
he was walking around looking at architecture earlier this year.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. So. Like, maybe he wants to go become an architect. Who knows? And so I feel like I trust the people behind the creators of the show to make however they do it, make it work. Because there's lots of ways, because I didn't get the impression that Carm is not going to be at the restaurant at all. Like, he'll still be cooking, whatever. Like, maybe there'll be some kind of transition, but there needs to be some type of cathartic, realistic way in which Carm transitions out of the bear, where we as an audience feel like that feels earned. That makes sense.
Yeah.
I can understand why he's going, where he's going. Like, I could see him and Claire moving to Copenhagen or, you know something like that where, and maybe it's implied he wants to start it again, but, you know, a little small shop on the corner of, you know, two Dutch streets that I can't pronounce and a little bakery shop. Who knows?
I think, too, where I kept checking myself all season long of, you know, in a Bad News Bears type story, they would suss out the, you know, there'd be some way to suss out the reviewer, right? You know, who's coming in. They would have gone to heroic efforts, and then there'd be some sort of heartbreaking cathartic moment, or maybe they didn't get the star, but, you know, they earned something out, whatever, right?
Now, is your audience old enough to know the Bad News Bears?
I don't know, maybe the underdog story, right? Yeah. You know, come from behind story.
Yeah. Come from behind, but you don't win in the end.
But yeah, you learn, you know, it's the memories and the friends that you make along the way kind of bullshit, right? So, And there's plenty of that because there's a lot of love that is shared among all of the characters and a lot of appreciation. I mean, obviously with Tina and the whole scene of Luca and I forget her name. The expediter, the woman with the pin.
Oh yeah,
God, is she the not one that, on
the one
list?
That seems to gonna hook up with Richie?
I am shipping that so hard. I am.
Oh, of course we are. Everyone is.
Yeah.
But I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, and she, I don't have her name.
She
in the list.
And the other dude used to work at Ever, and then they came over.
Yeah, well, Luca came from Copenhagen. Didn't he just come straight from Copenhagen?
Yeah, Luca came from Copenhagen.
Yeah.
But no, the Asian dude. I'm talking about the Asian dude.
Oh, yeah, 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 him. Yeah, yeah. Those are Richie's buddies for over at the other place. I mean, yeah.
I think it was Forks was the episode.
Yeah, yeah.
Forks. One of my favorite episodes.
Absolutely. No question.
Yeah. But yeah.
So
even in that episode, I was kind of wondering about Richie and her.
Yeah. They were definitely laying tracks. Yeah,
it's definitely stronger. That the one scene where they're
in the closet together or whatever,
and they're talking, and he's like, "Oh, was this too personal?" Question, whatever. Like,
and so they're in, right? So we're shipping her. We're thinking about the star. The desserts was the surprise pop up that we didn't see, but that's still great because it fills that emotional need. And then all season long, we're like the sandwich. Come on, guys, put it together. And then they put it together in this really interesting way. And but by all means, so all of those things in a normal show would be tied up neatly in some kind of bow, whether you didn't get the star, but you still made friends along the way. Or the sandwich shop takes off and they have all, hey, we have enough money. Hey. Oh, as another magical realism moment was the money in the tomato soup, in the tomato sauce cans. Like that's completely ridiculous. Right. So anyway, but whatever. So there's all these things that in a traditional show, we would be leading towards those and then wrapping them up. And then we don't. Or we do, but it's not in a way that we expected, but it's done in a way that's actually very real,
right?
And very probable in our primary world. And I think when the show takes a bottle episode and says, "Right, we're gonna lock down four actors in the back of the set, and we're gonna do this at night, and we're going to have lights shining in the lenses and we're going to have lens flare and it's going to be blurred. And Io Debris actually has to smoke and actually like, you know, she's actually coughing because smoke, you know, and all this stuff."
Right.
That they broke the episode out and that breaks all the rules of television. And I have not read this Esquire article, but I agree with the premise as you're telling me.
Yeah.
Which episode is it, or which article is it? Because I'm looking. Is it the Wildly Misunderstood one, or where does it go from here? Do you remember?
It's by Jonah Rosenberg.
Yeah, I've got it. I've got a couple of articles up from him. Oh, okay. So, yeah,
I read it recently.
Oh, anyway, I've got them both. I'll read them. So
it's the one that says the Bear season 4 finale is wildly misunderstood.
Got it. Yeah. Okay. I've got that one up. So I'll read that later. Yeah. Nice.
Yeah. How do you feel about Carm's decision? And do you think they're going to be able to pull it off next season?
I was processing kind of in the episode as well, now that I think about it. And I was trying, and now I understand it in a little different way because I did do a little bit of going back and thinking about it. And watching a couple of other episodes, and then playing the clip from Bodo Odenkirk right now about breaking patterns. I have another clip actually I want to play for you. Again, it's another a little bit of a long one, but I think it sort of goes to this, I think it sets up the question interestingly because what do we do with Carm? Where does Carm go? Because I think this clip sets up. This is him and Mikey talking at the beginning of the season. And so this sets up the question of the restaurant and what's going on with Carm here. So here's the clip.
He was an asshole.
Well, everybody loves restaurants. Even assholes.
I don't know, man. I'm in a restaurant every single fucking day of my life, and I've definitely met thousands of people who definitely do not love restaurants.
Yeah, well, they would love ours.
Yeah, why is that?
Because it would be ours.
I mean, listen, just because you've, like, been to fucking Napa, you know, it doesn't make this a not-fuck business, you know?
Well, I know that.
Grass on plates.
No, I know that. It's fucking hard, right? It's fucking hard. And that's what makes it special, right? It's fucking hard, and it's gnarly, yeah. And it's brutal, and it's specific, and not everybody can do it, but I can do it, Mike. Look, we could do this, right? We could take care of people. We can make it calm. We can make it delicious. We could play good music. People would want to come in there to celebrate, right? They'd want to come in there after they had great days, and they'd want to come in there even more after they had shitty ones. We can make people happy. Mike.
You and me.
Yeah, you and me.
You never really thought about this, huh?
I know what it smells like.
What do you call it?
We could call it Mikey's.
I think I got a better one.
Well, what if there is no tomorrow? There wasn't one today. Hello?
There is so much packed into that.
I know. So you kind of explain the end. They went to the clip from Groundhog Day.
Yeah. And I think that's a really important thing is that, so this whole sequence sets up the thesis for this season, I think, which is that this restaurant, Carmi wanted to do it with his brother and create this magical space where they could make people happy. But now there's these holes in his heart. It's based on on ideas that aren't necessarily true in life because, you know, oh yeah, dad was happy at these places. And like, did you actually know dad? And he's like, actually, no, I didn't. So there's a giant hole there. There's a giant hole because Mikey's now gone. And so there's all this stuff. And so Carmi's trying to do this thing that he wanted to do with his brother, but his brother's not there anymore. And now he's stuck in a pattern, and now he's stuck in Groundhog Day. And he has to figure out his way out of this finger trap. And instead of pulling away, he has to push in. And so this scene, I think, bookended with the episode 10 and with Sugar coming in and just giving him that hug when she realizes, kind of a cry here in a second, when she realizes that he's making this breakthrough. It's just... So it's such incredible writing. It's just such incredible vision for television. Like, I don't know another show that has done this with this kind of subtlety and at this kind of scale.
Yeah. And like, in fact, when Mikey says, you know, I have a name for another one, and then you, without saying it, but you know what he's thinking, right?
Yeah.
And
let a rip bear.
Right. And yeah, I mean, I think that's what makes the show special. This is the kind of show, and you can tell based on the number of like guest star appearances on it, you can tell this is the kind of show where other celebrities say, I want to be on the Bear. Like, they're turning the agents, get me on the Bear. Yeah, exactly. Even if I'm just for one scene where I'm a dishwasher, you know. And I feel like it's that kind of show, right? Where
yeah.
You,
John Cena, Brie Larson, you know, yeah. Rob Reiner. You're like, what the hell is going on here?
Sarah Paulson, John Mulaney, yeah. Odenkirk, Olivia Colman. I mean, the list goes on and on. Joel McHale as the guy from Community, Joel McHale. Yeah, it's the abusive chef that
Carney worked under.
I remember that I almost didn't recognize him. It was like, is that the dude from Community? Anyway.
I like the term to stunt casting. That's a word that gets thrown around with these kinds of things. And I love that idea. Like, yeah, we're going to watch us pull off this stunt. We're going to pull in this actor that you had no idea was going to be, you know, in this one way or another. And they pull it off. So I love it.
And I think the reason why they want to be on the show, going back to the restaurant analogy, is because for at least once you want to eat at the French Laundry. Mm-hmm. You want to see what it tastes like. Mm-hmm. And I think actors, they want to see what it tastes like to taste the dialogue that is written for this show. They know what it's like to be in a show like this. Rob Reiner is another one out there. Robert Townsend.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so I think, you know, I think it still remains a special show. I love the fact that it is... every year it's on, like, you don't have to freaking wait 2-3 years. You know, it's like regular it's like when TV used to be regular TV, like every year the show came back.
And at the same time, this is not right. This is not a normal television.
Not at all. Yeah, not at all. So I feel confident that they are going to be able to pull it off next year with whatever Crime and Precision is. I kind of feel like, is it official that next season is the last season?
I believe so. Yeah, I believe so.
I mean, I think it's ready. I mean, it's... Yeah.
We're done.
Ready.
We're done. I think, didn't he have originally 3 seasons in mind? And then they kind of pushed him to stretch out to do an extra, or was it 4 seasons? I forget what the number was, but he had it in mind, and he kind of got studio pressure to fill in. And so that's where I think 3 feels a little lost, because it wasn't part of the original plan necessarily. At least that's what I'm sort of. Yeah.
They squid gamed him.
Yeah, exactly.
We need one more.
And I think that's dangerous too, right? I mean, I get it, but you should not turn the bear into Poker Face. You should not turn bear into, I keep bringing up The Pit, but you know, that's right. That to me is an elevated show of that variety of year after year, season after season. You could keep running in a modern context, right? As opposed to an ER or Hill Street Blues or a MASH or, you know, what have you. Yeah. I'm showing.
I mean, the bear is telling a very specific story.
Yeah,
and so even from the beginning, you feel like it's the kind of story that's going to have an end in a relatively short amount of time. Like, you don't. It's not the kind of story you want to have go perpetually.
No, because then you'd end up jumping the shark, literally. Yeah. You know, so.
Yeah. So, yeah, no. I
look again, there's another aged. There's another aged reference.
Yeah, I'm sure many people out there have heard that. They just don't know the
YouTube jump the shark. Yeah, yeah, and you'll get there. Yeah, Henry Winkler.
That's right.
Yeah. Did you like Barry?
I didn't finish the last season, but the seasons I did, I watched everything up to the last season. I liked it. I heard there was a lot of controversy around the last season, so
I enjoyed it. It was in, I think I ranked it as my number one for the year, because it was just so, again, just groundbreaking. It was just, he was just doing stuff that, like, you just don't.
But
do
you brought it up because Henry Winkler is in there.
Henry Winkler,
I was like, what does that have to do with the bear? Oh, Henry Winkler, got it.
Jumping the shark, too many seasons of the bear,
Yeah,
we got there in the end.
Yeah, no, I'm looking for it. I thought overall I liked season 4. I liked it better than last season. And
would you put 2 on the top of your pile?
2 or 1?
You can't. 1 hard, just, hard to break it out. Yeah.
1 is just, I feel like every episode in 1 was just fire.
Yeah.
And it was just the energy.
Yes, music, Jeff.
That winter episode where everything just goes wild. I just felt like it set the stage. But those 2, they're very close to me.
Yeah, yeah. And 2 has some sublime moments, right? I mean, fishes and forks and what was the Copenhagen episode called? I can't remember.
I don't remember offhand. The episode is in season two as well. So much.
Yeah, I mean, it's a strong season. That's a really hard season to beat just for those three episodes.
Yeah.
But at the same time, for me, season four, it is the synthesis of everything that they're, and sometimes shows will synthesize things, but then not elevate it. And I think this is elevating the editing, the montage scenes, the city scenes, the music, just everything. To me, they were doing it really well, and now they're doing it better. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And you had those special moments. The conversation with Donna was powerful.
Yeah.
I think she'll definitely be nominated for that next year.
Such a good performance by her. Yeah. Such incredible stuff.
The magical table scene in the wedding episode. Brilliant. So yeah, man.
Cool. Well, I think we're kind of there. I think we made it through.
We crossed all the T's, out all the I's.
I mean, there's so many little details too. Like I was thinking about, there's one of the pieces of music is Tangerine Dream, Diamond Diary. And that movie, that song is the opening to Thief, the movie Thief. And it's a great heist visual thing. And so that means, you know, there are, I've got so many notes left on the table here. It's like ridiculous.
Know, you could go on forever.
Really good. You could really pick this show apart scene by scene. I mean, the season apart scene by scene.
Yeah,
for sure. And it was good. Cool, man. Well, what do you, what else you got going on these days? You've been busy at work. I know you mentioned that.
Busy doing a marketing manager, by night catching up on TV, and every now and then creating content. You can always find me. Just go to blurredronner.com. There's links to all of my
cool
socials where I make a fool of myself. And
are you still doing your YouTube with your friends?
We haven't been consistent with it, so I think we may start putting out for our Dungeons and Durags podcast. We're trying to get we're trying to level up and be consistent. We first got to be consistent.
Yeah.
Once we can be consistent, then we can worry about leveling up. But
yeah, you need something at the center of that to be able to drive the consistency. Yeah.
Yeah. So for now, for me, it's a lot of fun stuff to do on the side.
Cool.
And I'm enjoying it.
Cool. Right on. Well, just a reminder to everyone to check the show notes for the link tree that has links to all of our other affiliate podcasts. John and Marilyn right now are covering Foundation. I'm going to be covering Alien Earth. You're going to be joining me for at least one episode of Alien Earth when that drops. Yeah. In
is the new season of Foundation out?
Yeah. It just started. I think we're up to two or three. Yeah.
Oh my God. All right. Well, I thank you for telling me. that explains why I saw on the homepage of my Apple the other day.
Yeah. And John and Marilyn, I'm dipping out on the season. John and I started covering that together way back when we were stuff. And I'm just not into the season. We got access to screeners and I had to dip. But Marilyn is a big book reader and big Asimov fan. So they're doing that. We also just finished, John and Alicia just wrapped coverage on Murderbot. So that was really, they really enjoyed that season, which just got renewed for season two. Alicia and Jean are covering a lot of the movie stuff that were coming out, because obviously we have Superman out, we've got Fantastic Four out, we had Ironheart. So they're keeping all of that stuff under wrap. Whatever, I'm mixing my metaphors here. Anyway, they're putting podcasts out on all of those. And then, like I said, I'm doing Alien Earth, and I'm gonna do squad style, kind of like we did for Andor, where I'm gonna have a little rotating seat of folks. But I know you said you were keen on it, so you and I will
look forward to those episodes. Look forward to coming back for that.
Check us out on Patreon or Supercast. Links are in the show notes as well. If you like what we do and you want to support us, let us, you know, we would be great. I mean, it's like I think with the discount for a prepaid year, it's like $54 or something like that. I mean, that's a ridiculous price. That's ridiculously well valued for the amount of content and the quality of content we put out. And the other thing too is we're make sure that, like, you know, Ron gets to a part of this. So all of our co-hosts get paid out for being on the podcast and stuff. So we really make sure to honor the creative relationships that we have with all of our co-hosts and everyone. So we would really love your support. So check us out on Patreon or Supercast, which is just like Patreon, but slightly a little different. Otherwise, thanks for dropping in, Ron. It was good to catch up with you, man. I miss talking to you every once in a while. Yeah.
This is fun. This is great.
Cool. Well, I'll see you on Alien Earth.
All right, man. See you there.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.